surprise. Cosmic Cubbies arrived.
12 transmission steel bars and seats where science, myth, and magic meet. From 61 into the 70, exponential growth only in humanity.
I'm a vagabond.
It's incredible.
I'm a vagabond. I'm a vagabond.
Stellar. Fantastic.
I'm a vagabond.
Oh, it's uncanny.
Hey there, this is a omnibus bonus episode to complement our regular... I got to start out with actually saying the name of the podcast. I'm going to try this again. Ready? Hey there, welcome to Marvel by the Month. This is an omnibus bonus episode to complement our regular weekly episodes. We are going to cover all of the July 1969 issues on Marvel Unlimited that we didn't cover in our main episode with Miles Stokes last week, which is basically almost all of them. I think we talked about one issue with him. Also, if you are a fan of Miles and his excellent podcast, Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, you are going to want to support us at the $4 a month level at patreon.com/Marvel by the Month, because we're either about to or have just dropped a subscriber exclusive bonus episode where we talk with him for like an hour about X2, X-Men United. It was good times.
It was. Yeah, we could have gone on and on. We had to stop ourselves.
Yeah, it's it is a movie that lends itself to a lot of conversation and a lot like some excited, like, oh my God, this is so awesome moments, some kind of cringy, groany moments, and an awful lot of laughing. It was fantastic. And let's say who we are. I'm Brian Stratton.
I'm Rob Milne.
I'm Jamie Wenger.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, as usual, they did not put the July 1969 issues of Captain Savage and Sergeant Fury on Marvel Unlimited. Also, they did not put Avengers Annual Number 3 or Incredible Hulk Annual Number 2, which came out this month, on Marvel Unlimited either. But that's because all the annuals this year are just a bunch of reprints, which I guess is a good way to keep costs down. But anyway, that leaves us with, good God, 11 issues to cover. God, we have to get into this and just start knocking a few of these out quickly. But I don't think this is going to be one of the quick ones, I suspect. Rob, take it away.
Sure. Let's go with the not quick one. maybe one of a few. This one is called The Thing Enslaved. It's Fantastic Four, number 91, by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby with Joe Sinnott. It's very crazy. Last issue ended with the Skrull Slaver luring Ben into the woods where he was zapped unconscious. So this issue picks up weirdly with some 1920s, 30s era gangsters discussing their newly purchased slave, The Thing, who will be entered into some games.
Yes.
Luckily, Stan fills us in that we are on a different planet.
That clears that up. Yeah, I mean, there's no establishing shot here or anything to suggest this. It looks like you've gone back in time about 30 years.
Yeah.
And they're talking about having The Thing as a slave.
Did you check to see if you had missed an issue?
No, because I actually knew.
Oh, what was
I knew
coming?
About this one in advance, okay. Because I knew where Kirby got this story from. This is like a sort of an infamous. It's just like. Well, I think you're going to talk about how Kirby was wearing his influences a little on his sleeve at this point.
Yeah, I think, or you could say Kirby was watching TV and getting his ideas from TV.
so brilliant because I was like, oh, I'm going to blow them away. I think I know where this came from. And then it's like very painfully obvious.
Ben has been on a craft with the Skrull Slaver and some other Skrulls, and he is giving them. Skrull Slaver just makes me think of like lifesavers. I think that'd be
sound kind of delicious.
So the universe's least popular candy. Yeah.
And I hate the word slave, and we're just saying, which is a weird thing to say, but anyway,
that's a very
Very brave stance.
I also don't like being sick. So anyway, Ben is proving himself a nuisance to the slavers, but they have a bunch of tech to keep him under control and or sedated. This includes a literal yoke, like collar he has to wear for the whole issue.
He looks so sad.
He looks so upset.
Yeah.
It goes around, sometimes they let his arms loose, but it still stays around his head, but sometimes his arms are in it too. And it's just terrible. Back on Earth, the Fantastic Four begin to search for Ben because he's just disappeared. And Johnny is especially concerned. So I thought that's worth mentioning because he has like a little bit of character building with his buddiness.
I agree.
Yeah. We soon realize that this entire planet of Skrulls that they're landing on is modeled after gangster movies and has some weird gladiator style arena where different mob bosses pit abducted champions against one another.
Yep.
Our main mob bosses are Lippy Louie and Boss Barker.
Boss Barker, come on down.
Barker has pre-bid the 10 perfect power stones needed to purchase Ben. That pre-bid was a Price is Right joke for Barb, won't listen to this anyway. So Louie has the reigning champion named Torgo, who looks like an imposing sort of robot monster. Apparently, which boss's fighter lives or dies determines who takes over different territories.
Yeah.
So just go with this.
Yeah, it's like proxy war, basically. Yeah. It's sort of, it's basically what the Soviet Union and United States are doing in Vietnam right now.
So. Or in Rocky III.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Yep.
Allegories all over the place.
Yep.
So as Ben is being driven to the training area he keeps hearing about, we get a little report on the founding of the planet and learn that it is named Krall. It's almost Carl, but this
If you look fast enough, it is Carl, which I did.
Basically, the first abductee of the first slave ship was a man named Machine Gun Martin, who was a gangster who broke out of prison in the 1930s on Earth, only to be captured by a Skrull.
That's a real complicated day for that guy.
Yeah.
He's like, yes,
no.
His happiness graph is so hilarious.
Yep.
So the slave ship had been taking a lot of pictures and films of Earth in the 30s, specifically the US of A, I guess. And when the Skrulls of Krall got a gander at Machine Gun Martin and these films, the whole planet began to copy the style, manners, and what they called primitive speech of the gangster era. The whole planet.
Yeah.
So this gets us all kinds of weird stuff, like the 30s era delivery truck carrying the thing, creating a force screen around it to avoid a neutralizer cannon attack from a Red Baron style biplane.
And that's like, this kind of thing is one of my favorite things in the issue. And I think Kirby does this a lot. Like, I mean, he pulls a lot of influences into a lot of his things, but like when he combines like just this very like, you know, old timey tech with like incredibly futuristic.
It's a nice fusion.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yep. It's a juxtaposition that he owns.
The word.
Yeah,
yeah.
I thought of a word.
Yeah.
So anyway, this Red Baron style biplane is shooting at the truck. Then the truck sprouts anti-gravity rods, takes to the air, and shoots down the biplane with the old rear-mounted corrosive ray.
Yep.
So this is like an open-backed truck, you know, with like just slats on the sides.
Yes. Which has a sign on it clearly identifying it as slave truck.
So weird.
So weird.
Very strange.
So then we get to the Prohibition.
Just in case it wasn't clear. It's like these are the bad guys.
If anything I just said didn't sound weird, then you are on way too many psychedelics.
Yeah.
So then we get to the Prohibition era brewery that is the training area and meet the slave keeper, who looks like gangster film actor Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And who is named Napoleon G. Robertson.
I get it.
So the first order of training for the thing is to get attacked by Taxtor, basically a precursor to the Thundercat Panthro.
Super, super true.
He really is.
Yes. Almost exactly.
Yep.
Yep. I know that Kirby, he did wind up doing animation work for Hanna-Barbera.
He did. I researched this specifically because he did not do the character designs for Thundercats, but this does predate Thundercats by like 11 years.
Right. So, right. You know, yeah.
Somebody And there were a few people who worked at different studios with Kirby, but the specific person who said to have designed them didn't.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because I was like, this has to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Or somebody who, you know, took lessons from Kirby. But mm-hmm. anyway, in the skirmish, we find out that the thing's yoke collar thing is reducing his powers. So that's just a point I'm sure will matter at some mm-hmm. maybe next issue. Finally, we meet Ben's cellmate at the training area and learn that it is none other than Torgo.
Yeah.
He looks even scarier in person. A very cosmic Kirby creation of mostly purple looking metal with some blue headgear around and glowing yellow eyes.
Is Torgo definitely brand new? We haven't met Torgo before.
He's brand new, but that name seems super so familiar.
I think they just took it from one of the monster books.
I think you're probably like right.
They do so often.
Yeah.
So we wrap up with a quick return to Earth where Reed reveals that he has a hunch that since Ben was lured in the woods by a Reed lookalike, it has to be the Skrulls.
Smartest man in the world.
Yeah. I love that he just like pieces that all together. And
yeah, he's like, well, he's not in this room, so he has to be in space.
Well, and maybe he... You know, it doesn't say, but I assume he just stumbled over that decapitated mannequin head of himself that the Skrull had just, you know, thrown away and was like, yeah, that's.
And nobody else can, of course, look like someone else. No, on
right,
Earth.
Right.
Yeah.
Impossible.
Be ridiculous.
Especially Reed.
Yeah.
He's the hardest guy to.
Yeah. How would you get the height of the gray on his temples? Just
yeah.
right.
Yeah. So we started this off. We've kind of danced around this, but you were saying that. This is basically a Star Trek episode.
Yeah. This is so as we saw, like with Doom's Latveria that reflected the Prisoner television show, this is very pieces of two Star Trek episodes that aired in January of 1968. So one where combatants are abducted to fight in gladiator matches, and then another where that aired a week later where the USS Enterprise.
So we can say exactly when Kirby was. Yeah.
He was watching TV in January and started sketching like whenever I have to, I'm just going to punt this thing.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
This whole like arc. But yeah.
Which totally works because it is like a 5 to 6 month production cycle right now for Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
So this lines up exactly.
It makes total sense.
And I love the Enterprise, the Star Trek version is the Enterprise comes upon a planet whose alien culture is just like Chicago in the 1920s because 100 years earlier, a different Federation ship left a fictional book called Chicago Mobs of the 20s there.
And now we're going off on a tangent, but wasn't there a Next Generation episode where there was a whole like it was a structure where the aliens had they were just like acting out over and over and over this like mystery novel
in a casino
from like a noir style mm-hmm. yeah
I thought that they were the same race. They're probably not, but I thought that it was like the next thing that they got hold of.
Yeah. They're just very impressionable.
Yeah.
At this point, I
voracious readers.
Yeah. Voracious readers.
I confuse the holodeck episodes that have things like that with, you know, Picard as the noir detective.
Mason Hill.
Yeah.
Dixon Hill. Yep.
And what happens with weird alien races that seem like they should be holodeck episodes.
Yep.
Look up Royal Fizbin on your YouTubes.
Okay.
You see the card game that Kirk plays that he makes up.
Uh-huh.
So he's like scamming the mobsters to like distract them, you know, so in order to do that, you of course need a whole card game. So he's like, "Oh, you've got seven jacks. That's wonderful." It's awesome.
I remember that.
Yeah, Royal Fizbin.
Awesome. All right. Okay, well, yeah. One down.
Wow. That was a doozy.
Okay. Well, I'll take us through Avengers, which I think we can get through, a little more quickly. Not that it's any less of a weird issue, or, you know, any
less
fun.
The stakes are super low.
Right. But it is, it's a very propulsive issue. You really fly right through it.
Yeah.
So anyway, the story is called And We Battle for the Earth. It's Avengers number 68, written by Roy Thomas, art by Sal Buscema, and inked by Sam Granger. So we pick up where we left off last issue. Ultron 6 pulls the switch that should have triggered Manhattan's destruction, but nothing happens.
It happens to a lot of robots.
It
don't feel bad.
And leaders, a lot of people.
I feel like this is like the second or third time we've seen that trope, that particular trope
There's like book. There's three switches.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, the leader in the Hulk issue a couple months ago.
In like three of the Hulk issues.
Yeah. Right? They just keep pulling switches, keeps finding more switches. Anyway, the reason that that Ultron's doohickey misfired is because Vision wrecked it from within. But he's badly injured because he got beat up by S.H.I.E.L.D. and Ultron in the previous issue. The Avengers, apparently willing to let bygones be bygones with the whole, like, stealing the adamantium thing and, you know, partnering up with Ultron, they take him with them to heal him up. They discover that Vision didn't just steal the adamantium that now coats Ultron's body. He also stole the molecular rearranger, which is the only thing that can molecularly rearrange adamantium.
Sure.
Yeah.
Duh.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Does that ever come back into play in this issue? Like, nope. I wrote that down as if it's like, this seems like this is going to be relevant.
Yeah, it seemed important.
And then
the
I
time.
Didn't edit my notes.
Yeah.
So anyway, the Avengers, they decide they're going to call in a favor from the Black Panther. They ask him for a chunk of vibranium, which, of course, you know, he's a team player, sends it over. Then they bait Ultron 6 by announcing that Dr. Myron McLean, the only person who knows the formula for adamantium, will be addressing the United Nations.
In sunglasses and a red turtleneck.
Yep.
Like you do when you go to the UN.
Exactly. Hey, it's 1969.
Man.
Get hep.
Yeah. This isn't your daddy's United Nations. That would be the League of Nations.
Right. Which, which yeah.
You know, famously failed to, you know, to prevent World War II.
Poor little at Woodrow.
Yeah. Sick yeah. Woodrow Wilson burns.
You heard it here, folks.
Oh, you're killing me.
Okay. As McLean addresses the United Nations, he's attacked not by Ultron 6, but by the ultimate Ultron.
That's a big leap, right? Like from 6 to ultimate?
Yeah, he's also like 31 years early.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he was cooler when he had like that V12 for a bottom instead of like dumb legs.
This one, he kind of looks like, well, so I'm thinking of this because we just saw an outdoor screening of the Muppet movie last night, but it's like the scenes in the Muppet movie where Kermit's riding a bike.
Yep.
It's like just these spindly little arms and legs.
Yeah. You shouldn't underdo the legs on it on an imposing anything. Robot.
Yeah. Go big with the legs. So the Avengers spring into action. They're unable to take down Ultron, who starts to steal McLean's secrets with his mind draining device.
And McLean puts up a fight.
Yes, he does.
McLean puts up a fight.
Yep.
Oh, this is a Die Hard movie now.
Yeah. Suddenly Ultron freaks out and starts to self-destruct. But he's like, I'm going to take everyone with me. But the Avengers are ready for him. They cover him with a dome-shaped shield made of the vibranium that T'Challa sent them, which contains Ultron's explosion and saves the day. But why did he blow up? Well, super simple explanation. McLean was actually Hank Pym, who was hypnotized by Jan into believing he was McLean, because Lord knows it's easy to get Henry Pym to believe he's someone else.
Yeah.
Also, how effed up is that? Like, his fiance, who got him to marry her because he had a nervous breakdown and believed he was someone else, next time, like, they're just up against a fairly major threat, she's just like, oh, just hypnotize him again.
Is there any chance it was his idea or their idea, or did she just...
No, I think it was their idea.
It was their idea.
But also, I didn't know that was in her skill set.
Yeah.
That was the surprise, too.
Yeah. Wasps, wasps are famous natural hypnotists. I don't know if
this is like king cobras and wasps.
Yep.
And vampires.
Yeah. Bears are very good at making sandwiches, also. It's like nature things, you never know what they're going to be good at.
Yeah. There's just, I mean, I think we only remember like one or two qualities
exactly.
about an animal, but they're rich and complex creatures. anyway, McLean was actually Hank Pym, hypnotized by his wife. With a simple phrase implanted in his subconscious, something so alien to Ultron's nature that it might drive his non-human mind insane. And what was it? Thou shalt not kill. So got super churchy at the end.
Did you think
I chose it to be like, yeah, I did.
Yeah.
But I also, when I saw thou shalt not kill, I thought of Asimov's laws. And so I felt like maybe Roy Thomas is like sliding a double in there. But
okay. Yep.
Also, can you believe that that wasn't a Skrull? That was McClane that looked exactly like him.
Yeah, they're obviously everywhere.
Yeah, but I don't know. They, like that very end, it felt like, I mean, it had all the convoluted nonsensicalness of a Roy Thomas ending, of some Roy Thomas endings, but it really, the bit at the end where, you know, like just the Bible beaten just felt like a very Stan move. Like I almost wonder if that was something that like he was like, you know what would work better.
I'm almost certain when you say it that way, like that is a Stan move.
Yeah,
like, absolutely. It needs to have a big parable, moral, whatever. Yeah.
This is the last panel of a Silver Surfer comic.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Granger's inking too is something new, so that it felt a little bit like Gene Colan doing the Avengers just because of what he applied to it. Yeah,
he has a really, really like thick dark line, but it's also very, very smooth. It's a very slick inking.
There's been a bunch of weird shakeups in the bullpen this month, so
Ultron's face was terrifying.
That
like the frozen grin kind of thing. Like you see where like the scream mask comes from and like Jason and all that. Yeah,
it's totally
scary.
All right, Jamie, what do you got?
Sure, this is my lengthy one. I have In the Blaze of Battle, Amazing Spider-Man 77, written by Stan Lee, art by John Buscema and Jim Mooney. All right, we open with Spidey failing to convince the Human Torch to butt out of his private lizard fight without telling him why. Which, as we the reader know, is because Spider-Man promised Mrs. Connors that he'd keep her murderous lizard husband safe from any kind of injury.
Yeah.
Which sets up a weird dynamic for the rest of the story.
Yes, it does.
So the lizard's fighting both of them, and he falls. Spidey then saves him as he's falling from a great height.
That's something that Spidey can do flawlessly every single time.
Yeah, reader, take note. The Connor sisters listen to the fight on the radio, and the unnamed son vows to do whatever it takes to save his dad. And like to a modern listener, this would signal that the kid is going to maybe die or turn into a villain or something like that. But that doesn't happen. meanwhile,
It hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened
it's
yet.
Only been 52 years.
Yeah, the son of the lizard sounds like a great story.
Sure.
Yeah, and he really played a big role in the I think of I can't remember if that was a Fraction run. There was some.
Does he come back, the kid?
What is the thing? Yeah, I think it is because there's like young Kraven the Hunter, and he's getting all the animal themed. It's a Spider-Man run. Yeah. And Billy, I think it's Billy Connors.
And Rhino's in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Gibbon.
Nice. Is his name Billy?
I don't know.
I don't think that's in the story. I just think he's unknown.
If I'm calling him Billy, it's because I just think he's like, it's like a Lassie like character or something.
Yeah. Generic child.
Yeah.
Liz Modi heads up to the waterfront because water is a lizard's natural element.
Sure.
Sure.
I don't know if that checks out.
Yeah. It was like, aren't they kind of desert?
Stan science is flawless. How dare you?
Is this, I mean, amphibians or anything?
It's like, I'm no lizard expert, but. And meanwhile, Spidey hatches a plan with some like unnamed parameters on how to wrap this whole thing up. He's got a plan.
Mm-hmm.
So the lizard then briefly beats up a whole boat and then leaps into the water, his natural habitat, as Johnny starts boiling that water, which sounds to me so smelly.
There's
no way that is a pleasant odor. Spider-Man, who, as we all know, is immune to boiling water, dives right in to save the lizard, who's actually playing underwater possum, which is both gross and dangerous.
underwater lizard possum.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like if you're underwater playing possum, you're still not breathing. Like, there's still no oxygen. So Spidey suspects that the lizard is playing possum, but grabs him anyway to strategically cut off the air supply of water to weaken him. Underwater. Just, I cannot stress that enough. So Spidey's fine because, of course, spider lungs are proportionally larger than lizard men lungs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you can wash a spider down the drain.
More science. Go to our Wikipedia page once we're done making it.
Yes.
Yeah. Animalanatomy.com by the month. So Spidey surfaces with the actually, this time, unconscious possum lizard. right where he predicts that the torch will be, and they have a heated argument.
I hear what you did there.
Peter tricks the torch into leaving by lying about a Fantastic Four distress call.
I love that.
That he heard with his sonic spider hearing, which I too legitimately thought was real for a moment. I was completely fooled.
You're going to fall for the Johnny trick?
Yeah. I'm not smarter than the human torch. Spidey then breaks into a warehouse with the captured lizard to cure him with some dock chemicals while the unnamed Connors boy approaches. The Lizhard escapes from his webbing and attacks the boy, who legit kind of had it coming at this point. Spider-Man then dumps a drum of dehydration powder, presumably cocaine, on the Lizzo to turn him back into the lovable Dr. Connors. Then in a shockingly succinct final page, the family's reunited, all is forgiven, and Spidey kind of slide trombones an outro joke about his next fight with the torch.
Yep.
Yeah. It was a very well-paced issue.
Yeah. I mean, for an issue that is just a big fight from start to finish. They go a lot of places, they do a lot of things, and there's some really good like rising and falling.
Yeah, there's some like repetition with the torch, like continually attacking the lizard and Spider-Man stopping him with asbestos webbing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Awesome. But like, yeah, there's no angst in this one, mm-hmm. which is feels like a tonal shift from where this book has been for a while.
Yeah.
It's just a little break. Break.
Yeah.
The art was fine. Like, I don't think it was particularly memorable. They weren't doing anything crazy with the panels, or it's just like super good. Like, I feel like it falls just short of like overtly good, but it's fine.
Yeah. I think,
I expected less. I expected an entire lizard fight for a whole, you know, and I was frustrated, as, you know, many people with fiction, where you're like, can you just spend 1 second and tell him what's going on. You don't have to tell him the secret identities or any crap like that.
It's just fine. Like, look, I know this guy. It's cool. Like, I got it covered.
Yeah. Like, he's out of his head right now. He's got a problem. Yeah. But, you know, he's a good guy.
Look, we've all had nights like that. It's fine. It's fine.
Okay. Well, let's go to something much simpler to explain with very few twists and turns.
Oh, boy.
Rob, try, if you can, to tell us what happened in Captain Marvel this month.
I will do my damnedest. So, Captain Marvel number 17, called And a Child Shall Lead You, written by Roy Thomas, art by Gil Kane, which was interesting to see pop up, and Dan Adkins doing the finishes.
Just to interrupt you for a sec, the title of the story, this basically says canonically Rick Jones is a child.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Which makes basically everything that he's been up to since the start of the Marvel universe just seems so much more wrong. In
retrospect.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he started out driving a car.
Yeah.
So I'm always like, he's at least a teenager. Right. Come on, man. Yeah. But it makes him feel younger and younger.
Yeah. I feel like they have been de-aging him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which makes some of these zingers that are going to happen in this recap funnier to me. So the insanity with the character rebooting for Captain Marvel continues. I wanted it to be quick, but it's we're going to try our best. Last issue, Captain Marvel got his red, blue, and gold outfit, sort of the defining outfit of that, you know, that era of Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
He was released by the Intelligence Supreme, or the Supreme Intelligence, as we call it now, of the Kree, and realized he had kept the powers the fake Zoe gave him, which I still, whatever.
Sure.
So right as he's heading back to Earth, as the story's wrapping up, he unaccountably gets zapped into the negative zone. So as this issue starts, he's in the negative zone. He's talking to the disembodied voice of the same Kree Intelligence Supreme, who lets him see the life and times of Rick Jones, which just seems weird. He's just like zapped into a weird space, freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the disembodied voice is telling him about Rick Jones.
Let's spy on this child.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I love doing is spying on children. When I'm stressed out, what really relaxes me.
Yeah, nothing soothes the soul. Spying on children.
Everything feels weird, and then Gil Kane sort of ups the weird by his art style.
Yeah.
And It's like if Gene Colan was melting a little bit. Or Gene Colan's art, not him personally. No. So now we're spying on Rick Jones. Rick is in the process of quitting the Avengers because Cap has inexplicably started treating him like crap. We know that this is because the real Captain America is trapped in the Red Skull's body, and the Star Spangled Jerk is the Red Skull in Cap's body.
Yep.
Which is our first version of Steve Ol Rogers.
Also, I want to call out the first panel on page 3. Gil Kane could draw many things really, really well, but that dog,
especially if you compare it to the dog on page 2. Which is the same dog.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Its face just got about like 4 inches shorter between the panels.
Such a weird looking dog.
Also, Cap's body at the bottom of that same page is not.
Oh, the dynamics.
It's Steranko-ing.
That dog looks stitched together from the parts of like 4 other dogs.
But Jones, what are you doing out there?
So then we get a recap of Rick's life with the Hulk, with the Avengers, and even with the Teen Brigade, as Rick is sort of reminiscing.
Hey, I have a question.
Yeah.
So I've been reading these comics.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
Where's this Hulk and Rick Jones business?
It was much earlier.
Right as it started.
Okay, yes. So it predates the Hulk title?
No.
No, it's the first issue, right?
Yeah, so it's the original 6 issues of the Hulk. So it started in 62. It was canceled by 63. But then, like, when the Hulk would show up in other books, Rick would frequently be around him.
Oh, okay.
And then when they brought Hulk back as a backup in Tales to Astonish, Rick was in a lot of those stories, too.
God, it's 1969, and I already don't know the history of what's going on.
Just listen to the podcast.
It's so much to keep up with. Wow. Like, honestly, yeah.
Rick Jones is starting to manifest as possibly the center web, even more than adhesive to the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
I mean, people have made that statement, but
put him on the board.
But it falls apart here and there. But it's definitely part of Marvel bingo is Rick Jones.
Okay. Yeah.
He is the Kevin Bacon of the Marvel universe.
Yeah. Yes. Ooh, I like
you
that.
Can connect anyone in 6 steps.
For sure.
Yeah.
So after we get this recap, Rick, we creepily watch Rick hitchhike to nowhere, just the middle of nowhere. And then he's wandering around and starts following a ghostly apparition of Captain America.
Sure.
This caparition leads him to a tunnel and a giant spacey lab where he finds a couple of golden bands and puts them on. The lab is really weird. There's some giant, it looked like the lab was inhabited by a giant demon monster.
Yeah,
but
is that a statue?
It's a statue.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
But it looks like
it's his lab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. It's very strange.
The page is centering on this bright green demon monster thing that doesn't have anything to do with the story. Welcome to Captain Marvel. So Captain Marvel starts talking to Rick's brain from the negative zone and tells him to hit the bands together as hard as he can. And Shazam, the boy becomes Captain Marvel.
Careful with that.
Weird, right? that was all building for my one joke.
You can probably just go now. Yeah. Not going to beat that.
You know, it is wild. Like, I don't think I realized until fairly recently how ballsy a move it was for Marvel to be like, our Captain Marvel, yep, we'll put him in a red costume. Gonna have him turn into a kid. What you gonna do about it?
This just seems like they're baiting a lawsuit.
Absolutely.
Or another lawsuit, but more accurately, than changing into him, he switches places with Captain Marvel. So it's like Captain Marvel's like, knock these things together, and he does, and he's like, oh cool, now I'm in the negative zone and you're there. Right, nice.
Right. Yeah. I don't mind. It's fine.
So Rick's trapped
informed
in the negative
consent,
zone.
Captain Marvel.
Yes. Yeah,
is there any Kree understanding of that?
And then this is where the plot falls apart even more. For some reason, Yon Rogg shows up in this underground space lab thing and gets the drop on Mar-Vell, like almost instantly once he appears. And I'm like, what? How, what, did we get any mention that this was supposed to be Yon Rogg's hideout?
Yeah, no, none. I was very confused.
So I don't know why he's there or how, but he's there. So then he shoots Mar-Vell with this huge blast that should kill him. And we find out that his new Nega Band, which is what these things are called, these bracelets, these new Nega Band powers can, you know, help him survive that, can help him fly. So then Yon-Rogg is taking off to his getaway spaceship from his underground lab that we didn't know he was in. And he can fly so fast, he's catching this ship that's on like escape velocity. But then out of the ship dumps Carol Danvers' body. No warning, no setup.
Just a purple man dropping a woman who has not been in this issue.
Not mentioned. Nobody's been mentioned. It's just stuff is happening at a time in a row. And
I don't think anything has ever failed the Bechdel test harder than this issue.
Yeah, that is.
So he catches the falling Carol Danvers only to find out that she's a bomb and not Carol Danvers at all.
She's a literal object.
It explodes in his arms and then he survives. So Mar-Vell lands back on Earth, knocks his bands together, and switches back out with Rick.
Because why not?
There we go.
Yeah.
Welcome to Captain Mar-Vell now. Yep. Every issue is just like a, let's spin the wheel again.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Somehow this is not the craziest superhero that Rick winds up getting sidekick gigs with.
Yeah. The man, that guy.
Yeah.
It is. Rick Jones is such a weird character.
There's something missing in Rick's life. Like there's some part of his childhood that didn't go the way it should have and really has him looking for validation in very strange places.
Yeah, father figures. Although this time he was just kind of minding his own, petting dogs in alleys and getting in buses with strangers or whatever that was.
It's just, I mean, his real problem was he ganked some jewelry and then he listened to a ghost.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
that's the lesson.
I have a visual question.
Mm-hmm.
What can you explain? What's is that a back? Is so that a butt?
We're looking at page 16, the left side of the page.
It's Captain Mar-Vell getting zapped by Yon-Rogg, but it looks basically like he's falling forward. We're looking down from near. We can see the bottom of his feet and definitely his butt.
Yep.
But it looks like his head is just shooting out of his abdomen.
Yeah.
Like to the side of his abdomen. Yeah. Like
it's an oddly shaped. It's like a five-sided panel. It's a very strange shaped panel, and it looks like Captain Mar-Vell is just trying to fit himself into the panel.
Yeah.
It looks like another Steranko contortion thing.
Yeah.
I really like, are those shoulders?
I think his right arm is what we see his left arm.
Okay. Yeah.
So he's bending forward. I can make this make sense sort of. But back sliding up to his head. His right shoulder is down, hidden behind his leg. So,
okay.
He's getting zapped by like a photon disruptor or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the it's either two vases or a woman kind of thing.
Yeah. Is it Wolverine's mask or is it two Batman's kissing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Oh, that's the best.
As silly as this issue was, it feels like the start of something. Like now these two are conjoined at the Nega Band.
Like the old saying goes.
Now we have the boy that changes into Captain Mar-Vell.
Yeah. Right.
Which I do just, I love that. It's such a ballsy move.
Seriously.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk about an issue that does tie into this slightly. This is Captain America number 118. The Falcon Fights On, written by Stan Lee, art by Gene Colan and Joe Sinnott. I'm going to kind of go quick on this one. It just sort of continues where the previous issue left off. It doesn't really advance things much. It just kind of more of the good stuff that was in the previous issue. So, Cap, who has been, remember, his brain is in the Red Skull's body, and Falcon, they continue, making these guerrilla style attacks on the Skrull's former allies, the Exiles, who are sort of like the, United Nations of Evil. Cap and the Falcon also do some hug fight training on the beach, which is very romantic. The Red Skull in Cap's body continues behaving like a jerk in New York, basically trying to smear Cap's reputation among his most loyal admirers. One of them being Rick Jones, who we see crying his eyes out about his treatment at the hands of Skull Cap.
With the signed portrait of Cap at his feet.
Yep.
To my sidekick Rick Cap. Yeah. It says on the picture.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Nightcrawler has one of those with Wolverine, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Just like keeps him by his bed. I love that.
I will bet $20 that Rick signed that himself.
Yeah.
To my sidekick before they were ever, you know, the sidekick hero, you know, relationship. And then, but Rick is so upset he rips it up. And so this is a scene that we saw in Captain Marvel, which you just talked about. So that ties in there. We also see AIM getting closer to a scientific experiment that will destroy the cosmic cube that has given the Skull the power to do all of these things. And the issue basically ends with Cap and Falcon successfully leading an uprising of the island's inhabitants against the Exiles. But the Red Skull is watching from a distance. He prepares to use the cosmic cube to end Captain America once and for all. So that's pretty much it. Like I said,
it was like a good straightforward issue.
Yep,
like
solid. Great art, of course. But yeah, didn't really, you could have lost this from the whole storyline and you wouldn't really have lost anything except just seeing more of the stuff that you liked.
Yeah. So, yeah. You get like good bonding with, you get good character stuff out of Sam. Like, mm-hmm. You really get a sense of kind of who he is, and he and Cap training together was really nice. And
yeah. I would buy it for that.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
But it's an easy recap. So now I'm going to pass the mic to Jamie, who's going to tell us about Iron Man.
All right. Iron Man, Even Heroes Die. Iron Man 18, written by Archie Goodwin, art by George Tuska and Johnny Craig. An Iron Man LMD fights alongside Cap and Nick Fury, who are none the wiser, while Midas, Madame Mask, and Morgan Stark steal the real Tony Stark, who they think is an LMD, as a complicated plot to get Midas more money.
Yes.
I thought they stole him thinking he's just a guy that looks like Tony Stark.
Oh, wow.
That was what I was getting.
I think that's what it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Whoa. Okay.
So they just think he's some schmuck that looks like Tony Stark.
Oh, man. That was a lucky find.
Yeah.
Like, right on.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was replying to those Craigslist ads for us, like, you know, seeking Tony Stark type for acting project.
Robert right. Downey Jr. impersonator.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a lot of poop to go to roses. So yeah. You cast a wide net.
Also, I want to just back up to page 3. There's a picture of the LMD.
The robot face?
The robot face.
Oh, mm-hmm. Man.
It's so upsetting.
It's very Westworld.
Yeah. It's very good.
It also looks like weirdly feminine. Did you get like a feminine kind of?
Oh, the interior. Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, like, the mask. Yep.
Yeah, the interior of Iron Man is feminine. Mm-hmm. That was a nice touch.
Yeah.
So recent Tony Stark dumpy and emotional punching bag, Janis Kord, is being emotionally manipulated even more than usual by head scientist and probably incel Alex.
Yeah.
Who is apparently plotting against both Tony Stark and Iron Man.
Do you know who he turns out to be?
I don't.
Well, we'll find out in a few issues.
All right.
Bum, bum, bum.
Cool. But your suspicions are correct. I mean, I know they're laying it on pretty subtle, but
oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, one more outburst like that and she will be mine. It just is.
I smell a villain coming.
Yeah. It's real gross. So actual Tony Stark pretends to be an LMD and danger trains and danger flirts with Madame Mask in prep for their Mission Impossible mission into Stark Industries to do crimes. If the mission fails, as Tony is secretly planning for it to do, Madame Mask has secret orders to murder him.
Yes.
So that sets up like a nice story structure, because Tony doesn't know that.
Right. And she's starting to develop feelings here.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, I mean, Tony Stark has decades of experience just ignoring, you know, the emotions of women. So this is not a problem for him.
Right, right.
Yeah. He doesn't even care if he can read their expressions.
Well, no, you know, feeling blindness is a disease.
Yeah.
It's called sociopathology.
Yeah, you can't blame him for it. He wears a robot costume. Like, it's sure, not subtle.
It's not even a metaphor.
Yeah. After a page of some actually very cool looking sneaking around,
mm-hmm.
Iron LMD shows up to fight and like pretty immediately ruins the mission. So Madame Mask chooses in that moment not to murder Tony because he showed her just some basic human kindness / sexual tension that one time.
Right.
Like maybe there's a lesson in there. I'm not sure exactly.
Try to be charming.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe you won't get shot.
It's a good tip.
Mm-hmm.
LM Iron Man and Tony fight it out, culminating in both Tony donning the original Iron Man suit and Tony's heart giving out from lifting that suit.
Yes. Can I also just say, I love the trope of Tony has to put on old armor.
Oh yeah.
Like,
yep.
Yeah.
It is a winning formula.
Every single time.
Already a trope.
Yeah.
And
in 1969. Yeah.
In 1969.
Yeah.
And it just goes on and on, and it's always great.
It's always a treat. Yeah. I don't know why. And like the fact that he doesn't like it, you know, he's like, oh, this yeah. whole thing, like,
well, like, I also like that Stan doesn't like it. That makes yeah. it always funny when it appears
right,
to you.
Right.
Like, I mean, that was kind of one of my favorite things about Fraction's run on Iron Man was like the beginning of it as like Tony is losing his mental faculties and he has to like be constantly downgrading his armor set. Like,
oh, in order to, whoa.
Yeah. So he's like going back yeah. through the armors and it's just like, I mean, you know, if you read Marvel comics, obviously that kind of nostalgic attachment like
it's pretty strong.
You like someone who takes you on a tour of the thing you love
but with a huge emotional and
yes.
you know riveting yeah. story. So then you're just like, thanks for the excuse to do the thing I
wanted
anyway.
To do anyway.
Yeah. Thanks for making me feel slightly more sophisticated.
And that Fraction guy sounds all right.
He's all right.
Yeah. So yeah, so Tony his heart's giving out. But before dying, he Terminator 2s the LMD into a boiling, smelting pot of like liquid pizza, like it was like bubbling red, yellow. So the Avengers arrive and fly the dead but real Tony to the Ultra Rejuvenator, which will keep him alive while they wait for a miracle to save him.
Yep,
just like not the most proactive you can be about the situation, but
that's really a punt of a miracle.
yeah.
For a sports reference. Bang!
Yeah. Good job. One per episode. Marvel by the month promise. So the coda on the issue is that Midas remains unclear on exactly which Tony and Iron Man is dead and which one's in charge of the company, but kind of considers the whole affair like an unemotional wash. Like he doesn't really care.
Right.
And then Madame Mask kind of hears the sad walking away music from the Hulk TV show and just sheds tears over like what might have been.
Between... And she's got to be crying pretty hard because they're coming out mask. Her mask.
Yeah.
It's like her whole face is just full of water.
yeah. It's like, does that thing rust? Like what kind of metal do you have in
yeah.
there?
Can she breathe?
I think there's probably a tale to be told about Tony Stark having attraction feelings towards a woman with a mm-hmm. iron mask on. I feel like that's a story that
yeah
is right.
I think they do wind up having a romantic relationship.
Whoa,
down
cool.
the road. Yeah.
Do you see what just happened?
Yeah.
I came up with
you
an awesome story
it.
And it already exists. That's great. I also think the LMD didn't seem like such a bad guy for the most part.
Yeah.
Aside from wanting to kill Tony, which like fair enough. Who doesn't want to kill Tony?
A lot of people want to kill Tony.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's no more guilty than like Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
And this is one of the beginning ideas of sort of the artificial intelligence Tony.
Yeah, yep. right.
Which is a whole other underlying. I mean, this has already happened. There's already been an artificial intelligence that he's made that's, you know, near or ended the world in the future that he had to go fix. But the point is like the idea of him living on beyond his normal
it's
corporeal
like baked
form.
Into the character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's cool.
Yep.
The art felt very fitting for the story.
Yeah.
There were no crazy angles or like classic superhero poses. The faces were like maybe a little cartoony. It felt a little Saturday morning-ish mm-hmm. to me, but mm-hmm. like not bad. And the Madame Mask, you like kind of feel for her.
Yeah.
Like, they do a good job of like teasing kind of some emotion out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony Stark seems like a good guy in this one, whereas normally he seems like kind of a jerk.
Yeah, mm-hmm. normal smarmy guy I can...
Yeah.
Who's rich that I don't want to care about.
And like, he's not in the armor for most of this, which is when he's better.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It makes a better story. It makes a better character. He's vulnerable. He's like scrappy. It's just like more interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it just really continues Archie Goodwin figuring out that Iron Man is the least interesting part of the Iron Man.
Yeah. yeah. Right.
I hoped for this issue when he was like kicked out of Stark Industries and everything last issue. I was like, I want a whole arc of
exactly
him
give me a year
just
of this.
Like struggling mm-hmm. through trying to scrape, you know, bring himself up from his bootstraps with nothing.
Yeah,
you know, just take
yeah
it all
right yeah. Anytime they do that, it's satisfying.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you a little story.
oh boy
another very human, very grounded story.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
This story, I decided to take the Kirby books this month, and I sort of regretted it because of just trying to tell you about how this. I really am going to make this one shorter, so I swear. This one is called Galactus Found. Or wait, it's got an exclamation. Galactus found.
There you go.
Thor number 168.
Like the headline of the Daily Bugle. Yeah.
God, I was so scared. I was in the woods and I got turned around.
There's been
around.
Posters on every.
Galactus lost. Yeah. Galactus found.
Have you seen this planet eater?
So it's Thor 168 by Stan Lee, Jack Kirby with George Klein, which is pretty weird. We don't have Vince Coletta doing the inking, and I missed it.
Yeah,
it was that weird.
You just missed the peculiar agony.
Yeah.
But well, there's a familiar. There is. I know some people actually like Coletta's inking on Thor because it has sort of this like wispy.
Yeah,
like almost it feels mythical like quality.
Prince Valiant.
Yeah,
or it feels like Asgardian or something because of the line the lines around things like go from thick and thin and they change.
Whoa.
This is more like it looked like Larry Lieber cross hatching on the first splash page. So I was like, "What's up?"
Huh. Yeah,
That's not Coletta, and it seems too heavy and whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's talk about the story.
Yeah.
So it does what it says on the box with much ado and concern from Odin and others. A huge amount of, ado. Thor is launched into space in the Odin ship, which I assume is like the Batmobile. he waxes on about the lengthy mission, blah, blah, blah. And then almost immediately gets picked up by Galactus. The suspense was killing everyone.
Yeah, right.
I cannot believe they did that.
They were like, the audience just, they can't handle it.
Was Namor, this would be a full year of a story of him just driving through space.
So, there's a whole story about what the next issue, Thor 169, and I don't know the details. I know that there was some editorial,
they weren't mapped out that far. He knew then.
No, because he's kind of improv,
and he's just handing Stan stuff. Like,
and Stan,
guess what's happening?
He and Stan are not communicating very well at this point. So, all right.
Yeah. Wow, that's scary to like operating without a net kind of thing. Like
with Galactus involved. So
yeah.
If you get a surprise Galactus, you're in big trouble. which sounds like a really weird sex move. Sorry, hey, sorry, everybody.
Marvel.
Aw.
Weird.
Yeah.
It crapped out mid.
Or Hydra. So yeah, Jamie he's trying to view Marvel Unlimited on his desktop and.
Been working fine, but now.
It has a Hydra logo.
Yeah, it's a little
it
scary.
Image not found.
That is the most ominous. That's page not found. You belong to us now.
Right.
Your computer will hypnotize you in 5, 4.
I had a good run.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I'm condensing the story. So Thor's already found Galactus. Bam.
Boom.
Back on Earth, I'm sort of splitting these stories into two.
Yep.
The recently head injured Baldur is met by his Asgardian pals, the Warriors Three, Dashing Fandral, Hogan the Grim, and Voluminous Volstagg. Looks like they are all going to protect Midgard in the lengthy absence of Thor. They go on and on about this. Mm-hmm. And
they also talk for a very long time to a doctor
and
a guy who sells newspapers.
They don't understand things.
They're just excited to meet new people. I mean, you got to figure they've been living in Asgard for hundreds, if not thousands of years with the same, 600 people.
Yeah, right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that newspaper guy got equal screen time to half the Warriors Three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, weird.
I love the whole deal with them trying to figure out how to get a newspaper. And then they're like, we're friends with Thor. And he's like, you can have one. And that's how you do it. So they're going to defend Midgard in the east of Midgard, basically Red China. They have created a big blue, apparently unstoppable robot golem called Thermal Man.
Aren't we all thermal men to some degree?
Thermal Man is definitely inside of me all the time. So he wrecks a bunch of stuff as he runs amok, but they stop him with a sonic blast because his powers are still young. If his powers had fully graduated or matured, sonic blast won't do nothing.
Right. No, not against a thermal man.
Yeah, duh. So
who's so named because he has some part of a thermonuclear weapon in him.
Yeah. Or is
a thermonuclear weapon. Yeah.
So then they pack him in a rocket, when, now that they've subdued him with the sonic blast, and they shoot him to the States. To just, they, like, there's no other plan. Like, it just wrecks, and he's going to Hulk. Yeah.
It's like, it'll sort itself out.
Balder and his buds head off to stop him. They see some stuff on TV, which I'm sure is novel for them, too. Hmm. And then, meanwhile, Thor tries to fight Galactus, which is just the dumbest thing.
Aw.
He hits a force field. Galactus is just sort of sitting there. Like,
I love that. Yeah. That would have been my panel of the month. Yeah. I think out of all these. Yeah, it's such a great shot.
Galactus asks him to chill. And then Galactus starts a story about a watcher finding a plague ship and then says he has more story to tell. That's basically it.
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
It's so funny. The interactions with Galactus seems like they should be such a big deal, but it's essentially just Galactus going, you can try to fight me, but you're not going to be able to, and I just want to tell you something. Can you calm down?
Yeah.
And then, like I said, next issue winds up being, I think it basically winds up being the thing that probably convinced Kirby 100% it was time to leave Marvel.
Yeah.
Like, I think he was 85-90% there.
He's had several lunches, nothing signed yet.
Yep. All right. Well, I'm going to take us through Daredevil, Daredevil number 56. The title of the story is And Death Came Riding. This one's written by Roy Thomas, art by Gene Colan and Sid Shores. Daredevil is going to propose to Karen Page at last.
Finally.
Yep. It's definitely going to happen this time. It's definitely going to work out. But when he swings by the Nelson and Murdoch offices, he learns that she's taken a few days off to return home to Fagan Corners, Vermont.
Vermont?
Yep.
What kind of fictional place is this?
Yeah, it's a...
I think it's pronounced Vermont.
It's a Vermont, suburb it's of a New York. Yeah. It's my fair home state, which as we record this, in about 3 days, I am leaving to return to it for an extended visit, which I'm really looking forward to. So I wanted to cover this story because I think I am more qualified than anyone to judge whether or not this is a reasonable representation of Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah. So Karen has taken off to go back home to Vermont. Remember, she is still broken up over Matt Murdock's apparent death, Right. Even though she seems to be the only person in the story who is or even remembers.
Foggy's moved on.
Yeah, Foggy's fine. Yeah. I think Foggy on some level knows that Matt's going to be fine. He does this a lot. So when Karen gets home, she learns that her father, Dr. Paxton Page, the inventor of the cobalt bomb, has been kidnapped. And then she gets menaced by Death's Head, who is sort of, how do you describe him? He's like a mummy ghost rider on a skeleton horse.
Whoa, solid.
Nailed it.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, like an over-the-top version of the Headless Horseman from Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Mm-hmm. Here's the kicker though. He is straight out of Karen's childhood dreams. He's literally a nightmare brought to life for her. So, she survives the encounter. But Daredevil encounters him as well when he heads to Vermont to follow her. It's all very spooky. It's all very mysterious. It ends on a cliffhanger with, Daredevil basically forced to dress up like Death's Head and almost getting shot by cops or maybe getting shot by cops. We don't know until next issue. I mostly wanted to call out, though, Roy Thomas's attempts at doing a Vermonter dialect on page 7 when Karen first comes to town.
I was hoping this would happen.
So it's Vermont, like the Vermont accent is a really hard thing to get. It's just because it's not represented in popular culture, really, because it's a very small state. It's extremely rural. So there's a lot of like Mainer.
Looks like Stephen King, what I understand.
Yeah. There's definitely like a Massachusettsian sort of like, I mean, it's like generically Yankee-esque.
It is kind of like if you like add Massachusetts and Maine together, or subtract or divide.
Right.
Like, there's some equation there that gets you to Vermont.
Actually. Yeah. Like the first guy she talks to, who is, I think he's like the station conductor or, you know, he's the guy who sells you tickets at the train station, whatever that person is called. That's what this person's job is. And you know, Karen says, when's the next bus that passes by the Page place? And the fellow says, no bus, not no more. Changed the routes last week. It was a body be best off forgetting all about going there. And it's just like, it's very like it's New Englandy, but it's not Vermont-y. it's even hard for me to do a Vermont accent because I just didn't grow up with one. My folks didn't really have it, but oh, geez, of course, you don't want to go up that old Page Place. I mean, that's like a Boomhauer version of that. Like
Cajun.
Yeah.
The A-Y-A-H felt like the closest.
Yeah. But even that, like the can't get there from here is like.
That's more Maine, right?
It feels more Maine-y. Yeah. So.
That's what I learned from Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
And of the many things we all learned from Pet Sematary. Yes.
There are some other smaller lessons.
Anyway, I will try to, I'll try to do some field recordings of actual Vermonters.
Thank you.
So research are in the field.
Yeah. I'll win my, what do NPR journalists win? Do you get like a radio Emmy?
I don't know. I thought of juxtaposition earlier. Yeah, I'm done. You're out. Remember?
A Peabody. I'm going to get a Peabody for my working class Vermonter field recordings.
I am super curious now.
Yeah.
Yeah, this whole thing felt like a Scooby-Doo issue, right?
Very exactly. Much so.
Yeah. You get the new butler, you get a guy on a flaming horse and a mask. And yeah.
It was like Scooby-Doo drawn by whoever draws Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Yes, which is it.
Yep.
And that splash page of Death's Head is
very
awesome.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't... So I've actually read ahead a little bit on Daredevil. They don't explain... I don't think they explain the horse in this one. The explanation for the horse is awful.
Oh, right. Because even if they Scooby-Doo away Death's Head, they still this horse.
Daredevil also did attack Death's Head in a tree in this issue, which turned out to be a balloon.
Right. The balloon tree.
which is up there with fat garbage Thor.
Oh, man. So much.
Yep. Okay. Jamie, let's bring this on home. What did the Silver Surfer get up to this month?
What didn't he get up to? Now Strikes the Ghost, Silver Surfer 8, written by Stan Lee, art by John Buscema and Dan Atkins. We're going to do this real quick. Mephisto plots his apparently very justified revenge against the Silver Surfer by killing a harmless Satan worshiper and putting a limbo-scarred ghost demon pirate soul into his body.
As you do.
Easy peasy.
Yeah.
The Silver Surfer and Shalabal each space dream of each other, or do they? Mm-hmm. It seems like maybe something mystical's going on there.
Yeah. Oh, can I just, for one second, go back to the ghost demon pirate soul thing?
Yeah, I did kind of skim my skin.
Yeah.
crazy.
That thing, it's on page 8. It's a full page splash. If that's not a zombie, like if that's not a Walking Dead, like I have no idea how they managed to get that through the code.
Yeah.
Because it looks really horrific.
It has no eyes. Like the teeth are all jagged. There's like strings coming off it. The hair's all gray and white. Or like, I mean, it was pretty horrific.
Yeah. Yep.
Was that the Flying Dutchman? I didn't quite get it.
I think it was turned into the Flying Dutchman.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, yeah, we get some backstory on the ghost demon pirate before his soul rotted in limbo or however that played out, but it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
So the ghost pirate, or the ghost demon pirate, terrorizes the city in an old flying wooden ship in order to get the surfer's attention. And then Stan kind of passive aggressively blames the audience for him having to cut the story in half because they demanded Silver Surfer become a monthly title.
So we are not going to pay 29 cents for these anymore, Stan.
Yeah. It's like, wow, you're kind of a jerk. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, not much to this. I would like 5 or 6 pages of this are very visually compelling and the rest like is nothing. I hate to be so, the discarding of an issue, but it was just like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the it's John Buscema's art, so you're at least gonna have something really nice to look at.
Yeah, I think this issue though, compared to the Frankenstein one last
time,
Frankenstein one was not this one visually is metal.
Yes,
this
yeah,
is great.
Right. On the scale of metal to not metal, this is definitely
I thought
metal.
Frankenstein was gonna be pretty metal, not
no,
metal.
That was
this
not
is
metal.
Much more metal.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was, I mean, I remember enjoying looking at it mm-hmm. as I was reading it, but I feel like it was also one of those books where 2 minutes after I closed it, I couldn't remember what I had just read.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
There's like 2 or 3 letter pages in there at the end. It just, there's not much to it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yep. You can miss this one, folks.
You can miss this one.
Yeah. Just pick up the next issue. It's just the second half. Rob, what about Submariner?
Okay, well, Boy, I know you were all holding your breath since he got scooped up in a space water funnel
at
the end of last issue. This one's called Side by Side with Triton. Submariner number 18, written by Roy Thomas, art by Marie Severin and Joe Guadioso, Mike Esposito. This is Triton. So Triton gets a weirdly detailed face from Marie Severin. Mm-hmm. That it was unsettling to me.
Very uncomfortable.
And it ends up, that was just an aside, but he ends up helping Namor bust out of their space prison, which is it's not space prison, but that sounds cool. It's a spaceship that they're prisoners on. This is because he was caught in that space water vortex. The Stalker was the guy who caught him. The Stalker is also trying to figure out Namor's water world powers of gills and lungs.
Yeah.
They have a nice, Marie Severin drew a great, like, sort of x-ray view of Namor's head, and where you can see, like, his lungs and his neck and his pointy ears, mm-hmm. but like through him.
There's a subtle detail where the Stalker is looking at those x-rays and he's wearing glasses.
Yeah.
Like a very weird touch.
His x-ray glasses. Yeah.
And it's really funny because the Stalker, he basically looks like a mid-series Deep Space Nine alien.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yep. So it's just like, I mean, we're not going to do anything to you except give you some prostheses.
Yeah, he's like gray and a little pointy.
And lean
places.
Forward a bit, buddy. There
yeah.
you go.
Yeah. Here, wear these glasses.
So the Stalker is running a crew of aliens, and who I honestly looked through the last two issues and still couldn't remember what they are called or what their planet is called. I'm sure it might have been mentioned, but I could not suss it out.
Yeah, I don't know either.
After a couple of reads. So they want to suck all the water off the Earth and transport it to their planet. That was the twist I was
yeah,
amused by.
That was shocking.
Their planet, they have a water-based civilization.
Planet California.
Sick.
That's some Oregon, California humor. Yeah.
Right? There you go. The deep rivalry.
So they have a water-based civilization that they want to keep afloat. Underwater.
Yeah.
Triton and Namor are triumphant, but Namor was experimented on a bit while he was captured. So when they get beamed back into an ocean on Earth, we find out that Namor no longer has working gills. Gasp.
Yep.
Literally.
Yeah.
He can only breathe on the surface. Yep. So now.
And here's what we don't know yet, but he also, his little wings don't work anymore either.
No. So,
oh man.
I know this because, and here's a plug. I was on Douglas Wolk's Voice of Latveria and talked about Submariner number 20, which is two issues away from
Whoa.
This one. So that is the setup.
Which I believe is just called Mariner.
bam. Oh, wow. You are on a roll today.
Okay.
Take us home, Brian.
Yeah, I'm gonna put us out of our misery. Incredible Hulk number 120. The story is On the Side of the Evil Inhumans. It's written by Roy Thomas, art by Herb Trimpe. So the Hulk had a hard decision to make at the end of last issue. Is he going to continue beating up Maximus's evil Inhumans, or is he going to fight General Ross's army forces that just arrived to fight the Inhumans? Of course he's going to choose to fight the army.
Hulk fight army. Yeah. Hulk fight army.
He's the Hulk.
Can't spell Hulk without Hulk fight army.
Yeah. But when Maximus tricks him into almost killing Betty, Hulk goes back to fighting the Inhumans. Sure. So, you know,
Hulk fight everybody.
Yeah, he's omnivorous. Maximus reveals that his giant statue with a mind control ray in the center of Costa Salvador is actually a giant robot that also has a particle beam. So Hulk picks up a castle and drops it on it, and that's pretty much that.
There you go.
Yep. So that's what happened in the Hulk this month.
I feel like a kind of a wasted opportunity with those Inhumans.
Yeah.
Right? Like they introduced a whole cast of characters with abilities and looks and costumes, and then they're like, eh.
Yeah.
Hulk smash army.
No, thank you.
Stick with what we know. We know it works. Everyone loves it.
Hulk appreciate your effort. Hulk smash army. Yeah, it's... I think the evil Inhumans, I think, have only shown up in Hulk comics, right? Like, this is like the second or third time they've shown up, but it's like... They just show up as Hulk villains, which is very strange.
Yeah. Because Maximus was just the evil Inhuman.
Right. There was only one before.
but he found some pals.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Care Bears. You know, you got those core Care Bears, and then like the cousins show up at one point. Oh, yeah. And you're like, what's going on there?
What's this care elephant?
Yeah. They don't care as much, and they're not bears.
I've been misled.
Okay, gentlemen. So let's wrap this all up. If we had a buck to spend on comics in June 1969, and we already bought X-Men number 60, the only issue we talked about in our main episode, maybe the only comic that mattered, what would we buy? We have 85 cents to spend. Everything is 15 cents, including Silver Surfer. So I think that means we can do 5 issues.
Whoa.
So Rob, you have 5 in mind that you would plunk your 75 cents down for?
I've got 3 and I will make something up. Fantastic Four. That was bonkers. Just for, you know, the weird juxtaposition. So I can say it again.
Yeah.
And get my points.
Royal Fizbin.
Yeah.
Just look it up. You won't be disappointed.
Avengers 68. For me, the nerdiest thing that I've always loved about the Marvel Universe is vibranium and adamantium.
Yep.
So having both of them in one issue, and Ultron with his weird spindly Kermit legs.
Ultimate
Ultron, not of the Ultimate Universe.
Right. Bendis called. He wants his ultimate back.
Then I would do the Amazing Spider-Man. That was a great lizard fight.
Mm-hmm.
Then it gets a little, let's see, I've made it through 3, I think. No, I made it through.
I think you have 4.
3.
4. It's 3-4.
So I've got 2 more. It gets a little more slim pickings here. I would say Galactus Found, just because I was so amused by Thor fighting Galactus, who just sat there. And then I would probably do Daredevil. I thought the art was just exquisite, and I would almost pick Silver Surfer because of the metal, but I feel like Daredevil got there too.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What about you, Jamie?
All right. I would go Submariner because there was a lot going on in there. There's like space water and not space water, and they're atomizing water, and like the two underwater characters that Marvel has like finally jammed together. It was like, there's no alternate reality where this story doesn't get told. Mm-hmm. You know, where the two of them don't end up in
every parallel universe.
Yeah. And they end up in space, which is like awesome to take your underwater characters. Like, that's just great. I would do Iron Man. I thought that was just like a well-executed comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I would do Avengers for sure. I like the Ultron evolution is cool. The reveal with that it wasn't like the UN guy, McClane.
Yep.
Oh, that was cool.
And the Jesus-y parallel. Parable at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. All you need is love. No, you don't. Love's not relevant to this conversation.
A robot shall not harm a human being.
The Spider-Man one, another just like well-executed, fun comic book.
Yep.
Oh, I lost track. Uh-oh. What was that? 4?
Yeah, it was Namor, 4. Iron Man, Avengers,
Spider-Man. So I got one more?
Yep.
I'm going to go Hulk.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a fun issue.
Yep.
Hulk Fight Army.
Yeah, boo to that Thor.
He crushes a robot. He crushes a robot with a castle.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing is he gets pounded underground.
Yes, and then he like Bugs Bunny.
I laughed out loud when I read it.
Yes.
That was so great. What a great visual.
I might have picked that one.
Yeah.
And the physics of it are perfect. You know, like that is exactly what would happen.
I like that between the two of us, we pretty much covered all of the issues.
Yeah.
There's my picks. I think I would do definitely Fantastic Four, because I'm a sucker for the theme planet motif.
Yeah, sure.
I really like that. Iron Man, I thought also was a very solid like spy espionage story. And I like Archie Goodwin a lot.
I always look for Midas. That was my thing.
Yeah.
A weird element of like, I was trying to think if you could do that story without him.
You could.
Yes.
Easy.
Yeah. I think so.
Because what was the other Stark guy doing in there?
Yeah, he has no reason to
be in
this
story.
Was
it Maury Stark? He's
just like Tony Stark's crappy cousin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't really serve a purpose in the story.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
We totally distracted you.
You got
Iron Man.
Nope. Captain Marvel number 17, I would get, because this is the birth of sending Rick Jones to
into
hell.
The negative zone, into the limbo.
When it's convenient.
When it's convenient.
So great.
What do you like? What do you have an appointment, or you just want to like take someone to dinner? Just like send a child to a like a lethal alternate reality,
or the opposite. Like Rick's like, that's my ex girlfriend. Yeah. And then negative right, zone.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Void.
What else would I get here? Yeah, I'm going to go Incredible Hulk also. It's just, Herb Trimpey's really growing on me. I'm really enjoying
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And then I think I have to go Daredevil, just cause, for its hilarious, geographic inaccuracies. But also seeing Gene Colan drawing up what is basically a horror story is great. It's like,
that's a good point.
Very early, shades of, Tomb of Dracula. So, I'm pretty excited about that. Fun month of comics, and look, we got through 11 of them, and we still have space left on our memory card, so that's great. Well, thanks everyone for listening to this omnibus episode. We'll be back next week to talk about the comics of August 1969 with a very special guest. In the meantime, you can follow us on Instagram at Marvel by the Month. You can hit up marvelbythemonth.com, which has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. We've announced this on social media, so we can say it here. We're going to be at Rose City Comic Con doing a live episode on Friday, September 10th, from 2:15 to 3:15 p.m. So you have to have a ticket to the show to be able to see us, but we would love to see as many of you there as possible.
It's an approachable ticket for a one-day ticket.
Yes, yeah. It is. Yeah. Yep. And, you know, it is the first, like, decent-sized comic book convention that Portland has seen in 2 years. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think folks have got some, we got some housebound-ness to burn off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some a lot of nerd energy.
Probably yes. A lot of tongue kissing going to happen there.
Well,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Like,
let's not promise that. Let's promise that.
All right, all right. Oh, that was the reveal. Oh, no, I gave it away.
Our live show is just tongue kissing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe we maybe by this point we have already revealed who our special guests for that episode are going to be. But if not, follow us on the socials. I'm sure we have announced them there. What else? Leave us a review. Back us on Patreon so you can hear cool stuff like the X2 X-Men United episode that we recorded with Miles Stokes of Jay and Miles Explaining X-Men. I think that's it. We have taken enough of your time. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
I'm Jamie Wenger.
And we'll see you next week for next month.